Hang on, it's coming, Kevin. There you go.
It comes.
Dean is sabotaging us.
I don't think intentionally.
No.
He's our friend. Dean Richards is a friend to you and me and to...
the whole world.
To the world, really. Maybe intergalactically. We don't know. Hi, everybody. I'm Bill and that's Wendy, and that's all you need to know.
All right, show's
over.
You might
also want to know this. 312-981-7200 is our phone number and our text line. It's the same. It's 312-981-7200. Call us or text us, whichever you prefer. You came in with a boatload of questions this morning.
Well, here starts the sighing again.
As soon as I hear that sigh, I say to myself, I better put on my my glasses, my eclipse glasses, because there's trouble ahead.
I'm just befuddled.
By?
Our president.
Oh, no. Your words the other day, and I quote, I just can't stop thinking about Trump. And then Steve and I looked at each other and we went, here it comes.
Uh-oh, I know.
We both jumped off the tracks, yep. I think is what happened, yeah.
Well, I just can't stop thinking about Trump.
Here's what I have to ask both of you, because I do not like politics. I never paid attention to politics until now, mm-hmm. and now I wish I wouldn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. Why does he need to campaign now?
He needs constant reassurance. Of all the people on the planet, no one in history has ever needed more constant reassurance than Donald Trump. So he needs to put that out there so that some people will applaud and go, yay, 2020, Donald Trump. And he'll hear that and he'll feed off that energy.
I compared myself to Donald Trump in several ways. One, I have no impulse control.
Yeah.
I have no filter.
Right.
And I love for people to love me. Yeah. But if he's at these rallies, these people already love him, so why can't he try to win over the rest of the world?
I don't know.
I'm just befuddled.
I think he realizes, and as somebody who seeks that same sort of love, you know it's impossible to make everybody love you. That's
impossible.
I know,
but I try.
But he also knows that You have to be the biggest doofus ever to not know that you can't. It's impossible to make everybody love you.
But don't you try? I do.
Somewhere, somebody said, "Oh, that Mother Teresa. Ugh, that woman." You know, it's impossible. But I think he feeds off the energy of having any approval from anybody, no matter who it is. As you may have read in the paper, he has said some positive things about neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And just the mere fact that somebody, even though it was neo-Nazis and white supremacists, liked him, that meant something to him. Somebody likes me. Somebody's saying something nice about me. It meant something to him.
I'm just befuddled. That's all I can say.
How much of the Arizona speech did you see?
I did not see it. I read all about it and watched some clips when he was quoting back his announcements from after the attack in Charlottesville,
yeah.
Omitting some important words.
Yeah. He left out the part where he said there's really fine people on both sides, which is the part that most people gravitate to because it's the most disturbing part of a very, very disturbing press conference. But he didn't explain that, but everything else, this is a phrase, I'm a blackjack player and I would hear this a lot on a blackjack table. He would double down. He's been doubling down on everything. Anything that's been controversial, like a lot of guys would waver, but no, I meant that. I said that because I meant that.
And the condemnation of the media, he would be lost without the media. And isn't
he's
part
the
of his tweeting?
Of the media.
Yeah, I know. I'm befuddled, Bill.
You should. Everybody is. Because this was a million to one shot. This was something that couldn't possibly happen.
That's what you kept telling me.
It doesn't make sense that the host of a reality show is now the president of the United States. It's science fiction.
But it's opened the doors for The Rock and P. Diddy or whoever's running.
It's opened the doors for everybody.
You know, what's amazing to me is he's standing there talking about how the media is fanning the fuels of racism, and he's... You know, he's reading his quote. He said, here's what I said on that Saturday.
Yeah.
And the whole world has access to what he said on that Saturday.
Right.
Go to his Twitter account.
And he leaves out the words that were controversial.
Yep.
Right.
And how do you stand there and tell people, the country or the world, this is what I said, knowing that as soon as it's over, everyone's going to be showing what you really said.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
That's what I mean. I can't function every day now.
But even though it's unbelievable and it stops some of us from functioning, at some point it's not that you become numb to it, but you almost expect, it's not a surprise anymore. Like there was a time where it was kind of surprising where you go, there's ways to fact check this stuff. We can look this up. We can see what you said and what you meant. At this point, it's on almost daily basis, and he keeps topping himself. I was sure that his comments last week would be the
end.
Take
him down.
I was positive. I said to myself, well, this is it. This country is not willing to forgive a guy who says polite things about neo-Nazis and white supremacists. I'm wrong. Everybody just goes, throw it on the pile. Just toss it on the pile.
And that's the problem, because the when you started tossing the logs on the fire, they were big and they felt heavy.
Yeah.
Now it's just, here's another log.
Yeah.
And you're right. So that the impact of it and will be diminished, and people, you know, won't sort of step back to see
it for
what it is.
Isn't that frightening? That we become almost, I don't want to say numb, but there is an immunity factor. You become almost immune to it, where you just go, yeah, he said something like this Wednesday, and he said something like this last Monday and a couple weeks ago and last month.
But how can this continue?
How does it not continue? I mean, we've talked about this. The government set up, you know, you don't want to be able to remove a president on a whim. It's got to be...
This isn't a whim.
Well, I know.
This is no whim.
It's not a whim to you. But to a lot of others, it would be, and it's not something that's easily done.
Here's something interesting. I was watching Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC last night, and he and his guests were talking about the fact that there's going to be a couple of key Republicans. There've already been a couple, but there'll be a couple who realize that their careers are in jeopardy, and they'll flip. They'll just go, I can't keep supporting this guy. I've got to go in the other direction. And at some point, there'll be enough people on that flip side who realize their careers are in danger, because really politics is just a balancing act of keeping your career intact. So if enough people flip over, all of a sudden you have a credible group of people who say, look, we've been talking about this. We have to do something about this. We can't let this guy keep leading us.
He doesn't seem emotionally stable. I'm sorry.
Their argument last night was that enough people, mostly senators, if enough people enact something to impeach him, that at some point there will be a majority of people going, this is just dangerous. There's something on Huffington Post this morning, and it's something we've already thought about his access to the codes, you know, the nuclear codes. So this is a guy that a lot of people in and out of politics are saying, he seems unstable. Can he just go into a room and press a series of buttons and throw nukes at a country?
Yes. John Williams has phoned in. That's what all the ringing was about. He wants to chime in. Hi, John.
Hi, kids. Listen, I'm not on the air today, so if you don't mind, I'll just talk for the next hour.
No, that's fine.
All right, we'll go get some coffee.
Fine.
Well, Bertrand just did something that we've out on my show. If we do that, we have to throw money in a bucket. If you ever say, I can't believe it, or this is shocking, or I'm surprised, then you have to start putting money in the bucket, because we say that every day. And at some point, we have to realize you can't be surprised anymore. So we're going to put money in the bucket every time we say that, and then we're going to have the best Christmas party ever.
If we make it to Christmas.
So just tell Stevie O's, like, I don't know, 75 cents or something.
But, John,
so you're not working and you're still a pain in my side today?
I'm thoroughly enjoying, as I do every day, the Bill and Wendy.
Oh, you're
show.
Very nice. You're very nice. Yeah, but, John, isn't it disturbing where it does become, it's you're almost immune to it. Even though it's a circus and you're watching it from the front row, you just say to yourself, wow, I didn't think that could be topped, but he keeps topping himself.
You know, Bill, that's why we did those cuckoo brackets and whenever we would do them. So we posted a series of videos a couple weeks ago. We did a 20-team bracket, the nuttiest, craziest, most cuckoo things the president has said or done. And each time we were going to close the brackets and say, okay, we've got the field set, something else would happen. So we had to add that and knock something off. And each time we posted, so anyway, we had our 20-team field. By the way, the Boy Scout speech won.
Oh.
And, but doesn't that sound like ancient history?
Yes.
Because so much stuff has happened in the last few weeks. But anyway, each time we would update the brackets, I said, as Steve Bertrand has, this isn't normal. If we forget that, it will be. You have to keep, if not fighting the fight, at least reminding yourself that it's wrong to lie to the people every day.
And there are ways to check it. And, you know, he's supporting love and unity, and we all have to come together. And then this anger comes out in his speeches. And this divisiveness, and I'm befuddled again. My word of the day.
Put some money in John's bucket.
I'll just give you my paycheck.
Go with surprise. You each owe 75 cents. Bill, you don't owe yet, but I'm keeping score here.
I will at some point. I will at some point. Okay. John, just one more quick thing. I'm not working today, Bill. No, I know you're off today. I get it. I'm flipping around last night to the various cable stations, and this was after the speech in Arizona, and one of the political experts said, we can't be surprised that Donald Trump says these things and feels these things, but what we can be surprised about is when they do a poll and somewhere in the 60 to 65% range of Republicans still back him. They still say, yeah, despite all this, he still has our support. That's what's disturbing.
Yeah, I don't know that I entirely believe that. That's another argument I've had with some people. I think people are just saying that as a kind of F you to the Democrats or the media. I think the Republicans know.
Whenever the news
don't think they're cooperating.
Whenever the news is too bad for John, he just goes, well, I don't think that could be true.
Somebody has texted, hey, guys, look at your 401k.
No, that's what's buying him time. That is what's buying him
but
time.
He's now made this a 401 KKK, and that should never happen, John Williams.
Oh, you know, you owe him money for that, John.
One other theory about those polls that I've heard, and I don't know, I'm sure people could, there must be research on it, but that fewer people are identifying as Republicans when they answer the survey.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, because they don't want to be anymore. So, you know, yeah, are you Democrat,
wrong.
Republican, independent?
There's something kinky about those. I mean, I have a brother, I have a financial advisor, I have a guy I play basketball with, I know Republicans. They don't support Trump. Some people do, but by and large, they don't. I don't believe these numbers.
John, I've told this story on the air, and Wendy knows it inside out, but there are three different people I know from various walks of life, all three of which voted for Donald Trump because, and I quote, it was something of a novelty. We thought it'd be funny. It's not funny.
It's not funny.
No. Well, I think the only thing you can do now, besides gird your loins and hold on for the next few years, is to... And this isn't fair, but if the Republicans, if the Paul Ryans of the world don't start to stand up to this, speak specifically against the president, then you need to hold them accountable.
Right.
They're not on the wrong side of history. They're on the wrong side of the front page.
Yeah.
And if they don't want to own up to that, then at least you can vote them out in a year and a half.
What will Mike Pence do eventually? That's what I'm curious about.
Well, he'll look beatific. He has this sort of adoring look on his face when he's in the company of the president that I can't quite understand. Do you know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, he does.
Glazed and always kind of nodding.
Like reassuring look. I don't know how to explain it, but I get where you're coming from.
Well, and he was starting to wear his tie below his belt buckle. I think that's a red
that's
flag.
That's a bad sign.
All right, we know you're not working today, but we are, so we have to hit some commercials here.
I'm enjoying your show, as always. Make Bertram put money in the bucket
of course.
He says he's surprised. And Wendy, the befuddled, this cost you a buck and a half now.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
John Williams, he's on from 1 to 3 right here on WGN. We'll take a quick break. If you want to call, if you have something you want to discuss, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
All right. We do not have a lot of time here. We were talking about the rally that went on with President Donald Trump in Phoenix last night. And let's get to Pat's call. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. How are you this morning?
Good. Thanks. What's up, Pat?
Well, I listen to you all the time, and I respect him, like you guys, very, very much. But I have a couple of points that I'd like to express that may be in disagreement with what you said.
That's fine.
Number one, he cannot just walk into a room and press a button. There are checks and balances.
That's what we keep hearing.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's there, and it's been there for years, okay? Because of the severity of that particular action, there are checks and balances. Number two, there's a select group of individuals that are dedicated to getting him out of office. And in all honesty, the mob mentality of people has been known very well since the days of Rome, Greece, and everything else. And if you can incite a group of people to believe something or keep saying it, okay, in certain ways, such as 1939 Germany and everything else, you will get people to go along with your thought process. But the majority of people, unfortunately, do not think the things through enough on their own. They do go along with that. And the third and final thing is there are elected officials in this country that don't speak like politicians. They're not politically correct. They do things that they believe from their heart may not be right or wrong. I don't know that. But, the man is not trying to harm the country. He was elected to do something. A group of people don't like it. And I just think that the rhetoric needs to be toned down a little bit instead of constantly listening to the same. Everything he does, people will take issue with, and that you can do with any politician. So those that want to impeach him, fine, if that's their opinion. But at the same time, there's a whole group of people that don't want to impeach him, whose voices are probably not being heard.
Are you happy with how he's done so far, Pat? We only have 10 seconds here, so are you happy for the most part?
Not completely, but I believe that the man hasn't had his full chance yet. That's all. But I'd still love to listen to you guys all the time.
And we love that you called with a differing opinion, because that's what we need to have as a conversation. Thank you so much, Pat.
Take care.
Good luck to all of us.
I thought he was going to get stung by a hornet there for a second. Did you hear that noise?
That was
a scary moment. All right, let's do this. We'll take a break. We need a break, so let's take a break, and then some news from Steve, and then a lot more
show. Then we'll talk about North Korea.
Yeah, we'll lighten things up
by
talking about North Korea. That's coming up. It's Phil and Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. If we could go back in time just 1 week, we had Tom Mikaitis on, and our intention at the time was to talk about what's going on in North Korea, but there were so many other things to chat about that we kind of got lost and swept up in time, and Tom's been kind enough to rejoin us today so we can talk about what we intended last week. How are you, Tom?
Good morning.
Tom, a main reason why we wanted to talk to you about North Korea is because we're all wondering what might happen. I have a 14-year-old son who flat out asked me, should I be worried about North Korea? And I said, no, you shouldn't be losing sleep about it. I feel comfortable being in Chicago and not on the coast. But what's happening? What can you tell us?
Well, you gave your son the right advice, and I would feel the same even if I were living on the coast. I think we need to take a step back here and look at this in the context of 60 years of history on the Korean Peninsula. A lot of this is theatrics that Kim Jong-un is doing for his own people. His family has constructed a mythology that they are in constant danger of a U.S.-led invasion, and that only they can protect the country. They tightly control information, access to information, and everything else. So his desire to acquire nuclear weapons is he sees it as an insurance policy, maybe even a bargaining chip. On the other hand, he does not wish to be annihilated.
Because that's the end result, correct?
Absolutely right. And even China has said, look, if the United States launches a preemptive strike, we'll intervene. If North Korea fires at an American target, an American ally, then we understand that there will be a response. Now, it's not in their interest to see that country annihilated or even have its leadership collapse, because it would create problems for China. So they do have significant influence there. The other thing, too, is unfortunately there's a lot of hype about this, their capability. People have strung together a lot of what-ifs. Yes, they do. They have tested long-range missiles. The accuracy of their guidance system is highly questionable. They do have a small enough nuclear explosive device to put on a warhead. It has not been tested. How well would it work? Could they deliver it? Could they get through our fairly sophisticated anti-missile defense systems? And would they actually hit the target? And even if they came close, it's very clear they would face massive retaliation.
Is there an agreement in place, Tom, by which North Korea says we will not test these missiles, or does that agreement not exist?
No, it doesn't exist. There were talks that it broke down, I want to say, somewhere around 2009, that they called six-party talks, and there have been an effort to kind of restart those. Unfortunately, you have two individuals, our president and Kim Jong-un, who are speaking to their base with this tough rhetoric talk. And unfortunately, tough rhetoric from the United States feeds right into the messaging and the mythology that Kim Jong-un is trying to propagate. It's very easy to say, well, see, I told you, look at how they're behaving and so on. I don't even. I'm not confident there will even be any shots in the direction of Guam, and I'm not sure they would be able to hit it. I preface all of this by saying, you know, I'm speaking as a policy analyst here. I don't have the scientific knowledge to answer precise questions about the mechanics of bomb making and ICBMs.
But Tom, he's been saying all along, Kim Jong-un has been saying from day one, the U.S. is out to get us. They have an agenda and they want to destroy us, right? This is something he's been telling his people since he's been in office.
And his father and his grandfather before him. It's been the consistent drumbeat since the end of the Korean War in 1953. We still really do not have a peace treaty from that war. We have an armistice. So we've agreed to stop fighting in the Korean Peninsula, but there is no final peace treaty. So this is part of the Kim dynasty's rhetoric for the last, since 53, the last 64 years. So this is nothing new in that regard. What makes it new is the weapon systems, obviously.
And we had reports that Kim Jong-un said he was going to strike Guam, a big U.S. Base there, by the end of August. And then, Bill, you and I were talking about it off the air. It's like, why would you say I'm going to do it at the end of August and not do it the next day? I mean, that's kind of what confused and worried me. Like, I don't believe him.
I don't think anyone does outside of his own country. And even then, I'm not sure. I don't believe he said he was going to strike Guam. He said he would launch missiles near Guam to prove he could hit it.
Okay.
He hasn't escalated to the point of, hitting it. The Guamayan, I don't know what the word is. Nobody seems to know. Is it Guamians, whatever. They don't seem to be terribly agitated by this. And so the other good thing is despite the tough talk, and of course that's been eclipsed by the news on Afghanistan and the whole Charlottesville aftermath, but we're not forward positioning additional hardware and so on to make it look like we're about to do something. We do have military maneuvers, but those are held annually with South Korean forces, and I believe they're not near quite as big as they've been in the past either. They're just sort of routine exercises.
Tom, we can talk more about Afghanistan after the break, but I'm curious, do you find him, Kim Jong-un, to be more aggressive and potentially more dangerous than his father was?
That's really hard to say, and I'm not a Korea expert. I think he's, yes, because of his age. He seems to be more insecure. There was not quite this level of purging of people around him. That may make him a bit of a wild card. It's not entirely clear whether there wouldn't be some kind of palace revolt if his generals thought he was about to start a war that would have the country, you know, turned into a glowing parking lot. So I don't know. I really think the safety switch here is China. I mean, something like 80 to 90% of North Korea's trade is actually with China. They want him as a cat's paw. They find him useful. They don't want him to start World War III in the Pacific.
What are the odds of a discussion taking place to remove the impending doom that we're feeling?
It's already going on. You know, one of the things that happens when you read newspaper reports is say, well, there are no negotiations. What that means is there are no direct open sanction talks. There is always back channel communication going on. Even in wartime, there's a joke among historians that, you know, even in wartime, enemies have to talk to each other. That's why God created Switzerland, sort of a European history thing. But the truth is that you can be sure that those conversations are taking place quietly. They just are not at the level of formal talks. Formal talks signal a much stronger intent to resolve things. But it's in everybody's interest to find a solution to this. And it does seem to be quieting down a little, but one never knows with him.
The idea that Dennis Rodman keeps making visits, is that good, bad, or does it not matter at all?
It's entertaining.
It
That's
is entertaining.
About all it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dennis Rodman has never been, never left us with, with a source of things to be amused by. It is irrelevant to absolutely everything.
All right.
He doesn't have any particular thing there. Kim likes the attention, I'm sure, and so does Rodman. That's about it.
DePaul professor, historian, author. We'll talk about his books after the break, and we'll talk about Afghanistan. His name is Tom Mikaitis, and I have to tell you, you're kind of like my human Prozac. Every time we talk to you, I feel much more at ease. So I appreciate that.
I've been called many things, but I like that one. That's a new one. Thank you.
All right, hang on. If you guys have questions, 312-981-7200. We'll continue talking with Tom Mikaitis. It's Bill and Wendy on 720 WGN. Tom Mikaitis, my human Prozac. I won't say that every time we speak to you, Tom.
Put it on the
I
cover of the book, Tom. Put it on the cover of the book.
All right. We were talking about North Korea, and someone has texted us, and before we switch into Afghanistan mode, someone has texted, Winter Olympics, 6 months away. Guess where? South Korea. How will that affect everything?
Again, probably not at all. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is the North Koreans had the ability to destroy the city of Seoul just with conventional artillery. There's something like 8,000, many of which are pointed at it and are hidden in difficult places. Even the military could not take them out without before they did some substantial damage. Again, I doubt very much he would risk a crisis that would turn the entire world against him, launching an attack during an international Olympic event.
But he doesn't always think as sanely as we do. That's the scary part, right?
I'm not sure that that's true.
No?
I'm not sure.
He wants to survive.
Yeah, he wants to survive. That's the bottom line. And again, the thing is we have a habit of, I think everyone does, of interpreting everything said about us as really about us. I think there's a domestic audience here. Obviously, he doesn't answer to an electorate, but he does have generals around him who are rational about these sorts of things. And he does need to feed this national mythology of paranoia. So I think a lot of the bluff and bluster and even the tests are there. Another interesting thing is something like 80% of the tests have had various kinds of failures. So there's some pretty strong speculation that can't be proven that we may actually have had some hand in, say, computer hacking and sabotaging and so on. But again, that's a technical area. But I have read that may in fact have been the case.
Tom, during the war of words between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, several people said, really, basically, they're not that different personality-wise. Do you find that to be true or not?
I would say, in terms of personality, I'd say in terms of rhetoric, yes, they're clearly doing the same thing. And unfortunately, their rhetoric feeds off each other. It adds to the escalation. Because in a sense, the extreme response by President Trump in terms of the war of words just, emboldens Kim to go further. And it also feeds into, the "see, I told you so," America really is hostile. We have no choice but to prepare to defend ourselves.
And switching gears a little bit, on Monday night, President Donald Trump reversed his past calls for a speedy exit in Afghanistan, recommended the United States add what is being reported now as 3,900 additional troops. Let's just end this war once and for all. What are your thoughts on this?
Again, it's a formula for continued failure. I mean, I think he himself is not happy with this. There have been numerous generals who have commented and said this seems to be the least bad of a bunch of bad options. But what concerns me, and he said, we're not there to do nation building. We're there merely to kill terrorists. That's a contradiction in terms. This really is not a terrorist campaign. It's an insurgency. The Taliban are not fighting to promote jihad around the world. They're fighting to regain control of Afghanistan. And they're succeeding in large measure because of a corrupt and largely illegitimate government in Kabul that was seen to have been put in place by the United States and its allies and has very little credibility and not a whole lot of reach into the countryside. The other thing to keep in mind, we're going to equip and train and support. We've been doing that for 16 years. If they haven't done it, if they haven't got it by now, are they really going to get better with another mere 3,900 people? And what price in blood and treasure are we prepared to pay for that? There does come a time in which you stop doubling down on a bad bet. Say, you know what? We contain this. We put a fence around it. We monitor. We do incursions if they do anything outside of Afghanistan. But loathsome as they are, we can't win somebody else's hearts and minds or win their war for them.
One of his campaign promises, President Trump's campaign promises, was to obliterate ISIS. Is that at all realistic?
Which ISIS are we talking about? I mean, that's the kind of question. There's no doubt that ISIS in the Middle East is going to be destroyed, the Islamic State, meaning that it will lose control of the territory it has held since about the spring of 2014. But as we saw last week in Barcelona, there is a network of ISIS supporters adherents and even lone wolf just tag-alongs all over the world prepare to continue to struggle this. This is an ideological struggle. ISIS is drinking from the same, you know, well of inspiration as Al-Qaeda. You know, this jihadist, Salafist kind of philosophy of radical Islam that, you know, that others will espouse. So, you know, they're the latest emanation, but that larger threat isn't going to go away. So, yeah, ISIS is being squeezed and constrained. The more we do that, ironically, the more the attacks occur farther abroad.
And finally, before we let you go, we had talked earlier this morning about President Donald Trump has his finger on the nuclear button, but there are checks and balances that keep this from happening. How do these checks and balances work, and are they in place?
Well, I have to do a fair amount of speculating here because I do not have a security clearance, and I think I'm sure how exactly it works is a pretty closely guarded secret. But there is no button. The idea that the guy that follows him around, the military officer with what's called a football, which is the briefcase with the launch codes, you don't open it up and there's a great big red button you push and a whole bunch of nukes go off. There's a protocol and a system, and there are probably cutoffs, meaning there are places in which it could be stopped. And I think, again, you know, the military leaders would, in fact, probably balk at being given an order that they consider to be illegal, unconstitutional, or likely to start World War III. I don't really think that's a high probability thing. The president even, you know, is showing, I mean, for example, one thing that's good about the Afghan speech the other night is he stayed on script and he obviously was following the instructions of his generals, you know, because it was very uncharacteristically subdued Donald Trump laying out a pot he wasn't terribly thrilled with.
So, Tom, that scene that we've seen in every movie where the president puts a key in and then a general, high-ranking general puts a key in and then Oprah puts a key in and they all have to turn it at the same time, that's just in the movies. That's not real, right?
There's some variety of multiple key approaches, but I don't know. What you've seen in the movie is actually down in the missile silos. You have in a Minuteman squadron, you'll have in a particular launch site, you have two men in the silo having to simultaneously turn the keys, and there has to be a verified order and all that. How specifically it goes from the commander in chief down, and what happens if he's removed because of a strike on Washington or something, it's much more complicated than the movies. I can assure you of that. I
always feel much better after speaking to Tom Mikaitis.
Human Prozac, Wendy. That's what people are calling him.
If people
want that on the cover of my next book, Wendy calls this Human Prozac.
All right. Where do we find you in all your books? Where's the best place to locate you?
Oh, Amazon's got most of them. You just Google my name under there, and I'm working on another one on terrorism. And I also blog for the Huffington Post, too, on more current sorts of things.
Awesome. Can't wait to speak to you again.
Well, be careful what you wish for, because it's never good when you...
Yeah,
that's true.
I guess that's right.
Very true. We hope to never talk to you again, Tom.
And I won't take that personally.
Excellent. Right. Good. Thank you. It's Tom Mikaitis, everybody. We'll take a quick break, then some news, then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And we have Dr. John Duffy in the studio with us, clinical psychologist, author of a book called The Available Parent, and his podcast is called Undue Anxiety. What did you call him? I said Tom Mikaitis was the human Prozac. What did you call Dr. Duffy?
Dr. Duffy is the human Flintstones chewable. And I don't say that about everybody, John, but I consider you to be that.
I consider it an enormous compliment. I'll
sure.
take it.
One a day. That's it. One a day.
All right. Kids are back to school. I have one that started college, a community college, one that started high school. And Bill, one of yours left today to go back to school. How are you?
Kylie left this morning, and I'm not good.
Yeah,
I'm not. It really, you know, all summer long, the four of us, we went out to dinner almost every night, the four of us. And it's like a car that's now missing a wheel.
Oh,
you know?
Man.
Jeez,
yeah.
Bill.
It really is.
Poor sweet thing.
You need all four wheels to make the car
Kevin,
drive smoothly.
Kevin, hug him.
And I really should be better at this because I went through this last year with both Reese and Kylie.
And they came home.
They came home in one piece.
Is it harder on the parents than the kids?
I think it's harder on the parents than the kids by a lot. I think part of it is the thought that you just said, Bill. I really should be better at this.
Yeah.
I think we kind of judge ourselves like, you know, geez, my kid's in pretty good shape. They're moving along. This is the right, the natural course of things. This is what I want for her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I feel bad for me a little bit because I'm going to miss that fourth wheel on the car, you know? So I think a lot of it is just like, what are we going to do now? You know what I mean? Like, how do I regroup? And am I allowed to kind of grieve this? Or is it preposterous because a lot of people have it worse and some kids are in worse shape than mine?
Yeah.
And I think it's important to really recognize, like, I get to acknowledge my feelings. I get to grieve a little bit. And then I have to move on. Because I always worry about parents where if they're still stuck in it 1 or 2 weeks in, then I'm thinking like, okay, we're a little stuck in the grief zone here. And we've got to get past that and move on and think about what's next and celebrate where our kids are. But for these first few days where you are now, I think it's completely reasonable because it's such a mixed bag of feelings, right?
Yeah.
Because I can imagine you're excited for her to some extent, right?
I'm so excited and proud. I'm so proud of both of them,
yeah.
You know, for what they're pulling off. But It was last night during dinner. Everybody was making a speech about, you know, the highlights of the summer, and I'm not allowed to because they know that I'll start to cry.
You won't
I said,
stop.
Dad, we're not going to let you because last year I just made an idiot of myself.
Right, right. Yeah, I do find that it's unpredictable too. Who's going to be most upset? You know, I can think of myself and some other dads who I know. Who prepared mom for months that, you know, this is going to be hard to send them off.
Mm-hmm.
And then oftentimes pulling away from campus, it's dad who pulls over to the side of the road and falls apart. Mm-hmm. You know?
That makes sense.
So I think we all have to recognize like this is going to affect us all in some ways. I think part of it is kind of like what we're losing in our life. You know, like, oh, I'm not younger than I used to be. I've got a senior in college.
Right.
You know, like, what does that mean? Like, how many more passages do I have before it's all over?
Yeah.
And so we start to kind of take stock of our lives unconsciously and think like, geez, this is kind of weird for me because, you know, I've been raising kids for 20 years and now what, you know?
But what you just said is really the basis of so much of our lives is why do I get so emotional? We talked a lot about Tom Skilling crying as the eclipse took place the other day. And I'm trying to analyze what it was exactly that set him off.
Right.
But we talked about this. I cried when the Cubs and the White Sox won the World Series. You cry at the silliest things. So I'm thinking to myself, life is going according to plan. We knew when we had kids that they would go away to college.
Absolutely.
This is no shock.
Right, right. And I think just to take a little bit of a left turn, I think I think we're not supposed to get emotional about things, you know, like crying about the World Series, crying during a certain song when it comes on the air, you know, certain things just get to us. And I think it's okay.
You mean Seasons in the Sun, don't you?
Of course I do.
Yeah, I could tell by the way you said it. Yeah.
And if we don't let ourselves feel what we feel, we're bottling something up. And I don't think it's very natural. And I don't think it's very good modeling for kids. You know, I really don't, especially as guys.
Yeah.
I think we guys have to be willing to show how we feel about things. You know,
I love seeing the sensitive side of a man. Not all the time. Like, Bill, sometimes you might be a crybaby.
I go too far. I do.
But I think it just shows that we're all human. We're all the same.
Yeah.
We all experience things that make us sad and proud and emotional.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And to your point, Wendy, I think we can overdo that too. And, you know, and then you get the eye roll. You know what I mean? If you're the one who's always bringing the emotion to every table, eventually people get tired of that. There's a fatigue affiliated with that as well. So you want to be able to modulate your own emotions too.
Although, I will say this, my little guy tells me I cry too much, which I don't really anymore. I've been, you know, not big problems anymore.
Right.
And sometimes I just get to an overload where it's like, oh, God, you guys, come on. I've made dinner 5 nights in a row and no one's here at the same time. And I have like I'm not hysterical, but Dylan says to me, kids don't like to see their parents cry. You're supposed to be our rock.
But there's
what
something
does that
to
mean?
That. I imagine it's very jarring for most kids. You go, well, there's the most solid person in my life, and they're weeping. What's going on there?
Right, right. No, I agree with that. I think it's probably important not to just stuff it down, unless it's happening every day, but this is every 5 days. Right. But to explain to your kids, like, okay, this is why I'm upset right now, you know, and let them give them some context for it so they don't just think, like, the sky's falling, you know, because I think that's when kids see their parents upset on a regular basis, they're kind of geared for a crisis anytime, you know, and they don't know what that means. You know, are mom and dad okay? Or is somebody losing their job? Is something going to shake my world?
They read more into
here?
It, perhaps. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I'll stop crying when I break a nail from now on. But no, I've really tried to handle that. And every once in a while, you have just this breakdown moment where it's like, oh, that's it. I got to unload, you know? So it happens.
Well, and that might be good modeling for kids. Just like, hey, you know what? Once in a while, you're going to have a breakdown moment. It's not the end of the world. Go ahead. Let it out.
And you pick yourself up and you move back and everything's fine.
Right. Exactly.
But do you remember like how often when you were a kid, I know you lost your dad early on, but do you remember how often you saw your mom cry?
I never saw her cry.
And like
and that,
that
made me think
head.
She wasn't human. And I'm totally kidding. She was really strong, so I think if I saw her cry, it would have really upset me, like something terrible was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one thought about that is, you know, I think we all grew up thinking crying was some kind of a sign of weakness, like the showing of emotion. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with this woman, Brené Brown. She's a professor down at the University of Houston, and she wrote a book a few years ago called Loving Bravely. And it was just really about like being willing to be vulnerable and out there and how there's strength in that, not weakness. And it kind of turns that whole idea on its head that you're willing to show emotion and there's a certain strength to that. And I think that's probably a pretty important concept that I find kids get pretty readily. I think we're struggling to get that, but kids get it. They're like, when they come to my office, they're willing to fall apart a little bit.
Yeah.
As long as they know they can pull it together walking out the door, you know?
But those days where a guy crying, like we had years and years and years and years where if a guy was crying, that was the ultimate sign of weakness and that was bad for everybody. That's let up a bit, right?
Oh, well, you think about the Tom Skilling moment, right? Yeah. I mean, how many...
That
how
made me
viral.
Love him more. Yeah.
Everybody, it made everybody love Tom more. Like, you know, wow, he's so passionate about what he does. And this is there's no act affiliated with it. Obviously, he is moved by this moment, you know? And I think we all were, like, completely respectful of that, right? It was kind of like he let us into his world deeply. And it was pretty cool. So, yeah, I think that's changing fast.
Do you remember when Mike Schmidt of the Phillies retired and he had a press conference and he just wept the whole time from the time they announced him until he made his speech? He just kept on crying.
Yeah.
And everybody was making fun of him. But I was going, oh, no, this guy, he won't be able to do what he loves the most playing baseball anymore. I get it. Why wouldn't you cry?
Completely reasonable reaction, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, why wouldn't he cry? I agree completely.
But if he cried today, I think people would react differently than he did many years ago.
Probably.
'Cause, and men. Especially, and I can't speak for all men, but they do not want to show weakness. But their weakness is part of our everyday life.
Yeah,
right, right. And I don't know that crying necessarily denotes weakness. I think it just denotes emotional reality. You know,
I cried when Michael graduated from high school this past year. We were taking a picture, and I put it on my Facebook page, and it's me just kind of crying, not hysterically, but and he was mocking me.
Oh yeah.
Sure. You know? And I said, I'm sorry. I'm not sad.
Right.
I'm proud. I was just – crying is a release of an emoticon of emotions. I mean, it's just all of them coming together, and sometimes you can't hold it back.
Well, that's a really good point. Crying isn't always grief or sadness or something like that. The Skilling moment, my Springsteen moments at every single concert. these are tears of joy, right?
Because you know Dancing in the Dark is coming. You just don't know when it's coming.
Exactly. It's when it shows up, my God, who can hold it together?
Impossible.
That's the key. It's not always about sadness.
Right.
Yeah. So true. All right, let's take a quick break. Dr. John Duffy's here. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, we'll get that done. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, Dr. John Duffy is with us. He is a clinical psychologist. His book, The Available Parent, is awesome. And his podcast, Undo Anxiety, is heard here at WGNplus.com, or you can find it on iTunes. Dr. Duffy, we were talking about going away to school. I will confess two sad stories to you. My sister's a little older than I am, and when she went away to U of I took a shower and I cried. We fought all the time, but the fact that she was not going to be living in our house really upset me. And then when I went away to Illinois State, as soon as my mom and sister pulled away, I had a good time that day figuring things out. But that night, I was a big crybaby, and I only made it a little over a semester. I was homesick.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? Homesickness is something
that sucks.
It sucks. And an awful lot of kids go through it. And as much as I've tried over 20 plus years to figure out, like, you know, what's the formula? How can I predict whether a kid is going to be homesick? It's really hard to predict. Sometimes the kids who get along best with their parents and they miss their dog and they want to be back home with the dog. And so, and some kids can predict it from 2 years coming, you know, like as sophomores in high school, they can say, I know I'm going to be homesick when I go away. And then some high school kids, even during the course of a 7 hour day, get homesick and want to get home very quickly. So it's tough to predict. It's important for parents to realize homesickness isn't terminal. It's different than it used to be because we have all these ways of keeping in touch with our kids. And my strong bias is, unless you have a remarkably compelling reason to go and pick your child up and call the semester, usually it's just kind of a bridge to get past. And once you're past the bridge and your child is kind of ensconced in life wherever they are, they do perfectly fine, you know?
Do most, if not all, schools have some sort of a program in place by which a kid can come in and say, "Hey, I've only been here a couple of weeks, but I'm struggling. I need to talk to somebody." They have that in place, don't they?
I do not know the school that doesn't have a community counseling center, a school counseling center somewhere on campus. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
So can I tell you, if texting and cell phones were around when I went away to school, I bet I would have made it. I really do, because they're
more connected.
Yeah. 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 Just even if you're just like, "Mom, thinking about you," or "What's my dog doing now?"
Yep.
I think a quick picture. Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? A quick picture, a quick FaceTime, something like that, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden you feel like way more connected than you would have otherwise. And this isn't to judge anybody who decides, like, you know what, my kid just isn't thriving, so we're going to come home and regroup. There might be a point in the semester where you feel like, okay, I need to do that. But my bias is, don't jump the gun on that. Give it a few weeks, because some kids need some time to get acclimated. Some kids are more sensitive than others. Some kids are a little more socially reserved than others, so it's really hard to find their way. So give them a little bit of a berth to find their space and follow their lead. If they're reaching out to you, reach back and give them what they need. Give them some encouragement. But if they're not reaching out, step back and let them figure it out on their own.
Yeah,
you know?
Good advice.
Yeah.
I want my kids to do well. Sometimes, you know, they probably could be straight A students. They're not. And at some point you just kind of go, well, they'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But the two things I want are for my kids to be happy and to stay alive. So that has something to do with when you think it may be time to bring them home.
Yes. Yeah. If you think that there's any threat to health or safety, then you've got to call it. In my book, you know, like, that is not a risk worth taking. There's always another semester. And the, I don't know if you guys saw, about a year ago, Time Magazine had an article that said 30 years ago, the average time it took to finish college was about 4.1 years or so. Now it's a solid 5 years.
Wow, really?
So, yeah. So taking a gap semester, or taking a year.
Yeah.
Lower load. I mean, now they've dropped some of the requirements, like at COD, College of DuPage, 12 hours is full time.
And that's true at a lot of universities, too. So, you know, like, so you can get away with taking fewer classes. And so, yeah, make those adjustments. But yeah, I mean, once health and safety becomes a risk, my strong bias is, take your kids home, regroup. Do not put that risk out there and, you know, risk potential regret.
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
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 Linda, we're talking to Dr. John Duffy. You have a comment or question?
Hello.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. So I just dropped my son off at Colorado, at a school in Colorado just this past week, and he just seems to have an issue just connecting. He was incredibly, like, social and happy in high school and had a ton of friends, and I'm just kind of shocked by his reaction. And just, you know, I've been listening to you guys, so I'm guessing that's kind of normal. How long, you know, am I on course with that or no?
Absolutely, Linda. Especially for kids who I think were popular and the social thing came real easy in high school, I think it's real tricky to get to a college where it's like, okay, I don't know that many people. I'm not really king of this hill, so I've got to learn how to navigate that. My bias would be to support him in any way he's asking you to. And if there's any advice I would have for him that you can kind of pass along, these early couple of weeks in college, everybody's really nervous. Everybody's really anxious. And nobody knows exactly what to do. They're worried about navigating the awkwardness of those initial conversations and things. So if you can get your son to be the guy who is reaching out his hand and saying, "Hi, I'm Bob. I'm from Chicago. Nice to meet you." If he starts those conversations, if he has a little pizza party in his dorm room, suddenly he will formulate friendships really, really quickly. And I find this over and over and over again with the kids I work with. So that might be a way to kind of break the mold for him a little bit there.
But it sucks being a mom at home knowing that maybe things aren't going so perfectly. I get where you're coming from, Linda.
Yeah, it's been, you know, and like I said, it's only been a week, but just, you know, the mom instincts are just, you want, like you said, you want your kid to be happy.
That's it.
Absolutely.
Good
so
luck.
Tricky. Yeah.
Thank you.
But you are essentially, you're starting over. All through grade school and high school, you kind of knew that same group of kids, and you built up kind of a backstory, and all of a sudden everything's new.
Absolutely.
It's not the easiest thing in the world for some
people. It's like getting a new job, though. It's the same thing, you know, where you are in a groove where you were, and then you go to a new location, and it's like, oh, crap, I got to meet people again. It prepares you for a new job when you go away to school.
Right. So it's all starting over. If you think about it from the other point of view, for kids who struggled in high school and grade school socially, there's this opportunity then to kind of change the narrative of your social life, right? And to be the guy or the girl who is kind of a little more outgoing or just finds their people, you know, because campuses tend to be bigger than high school or grade school campuses.
Right.
So there's this opportunity to find people who are more like-minded. And if you're just vigilant for that early on, you're more likely to find it.
Yep.
DrJohnDuffy.com, thank you for coming by. Your son, George, a senior year, was it just as hard to let him go back this time as it was his freshman year?
I'm going to be honest with you guys. It was a little harder.
Why?
In large part because this was the last time, and we were, my wife Julie and I were both keenly aware of that. Mm-hmm. So this one was tough.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
I know it seems crazy.
Maybe you
but
two should hug each other.
Yeah,
we're going to give a big hug.
Right.
We'll hug after we're done.
Thank you, John. Quick
Thanks,
break. Guys. We'll be back with the news and more things, including I'm going to the Sox game tonight, and I have some Sox information I want to share with you.
Oh, excellent.
All right.
Very
it's
good.
Bill F. Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN.
White Sox! White Sox!
Go White Sox!
Let's go White Sox!
I'm going to the Sox game tonight. I am feeling kind of guilty because I haven't been to the ballpark in probably 2 years.
Some fan you've turned out to be.
Well, they're...
That's why they're hurting.
What's the name of the ballpark?
You can do this. Chico's Bail Bonds
no,
Ballpark.
No, Guaranteed Rate Field.
Guaranteed Rate Field.
You got it.
I know where I'm going. And I was watching...
Why has it been so long? What were you doing that was more important than cheering on your favorite baseball team? It's America's pastime. I'm embarrassed.
I fell in love with hockey, and honestly, the games were going a little slow for me.
But they're at different times of the year.
I know, but I don't know. It's not just me. Jimmy Mack didn't go either, and he is like born and bred White Sox fan.
You owe everybody at White Sox Park, Guaranteed Rate Field, an apology.
I'm still calling it White Sox
Carlos
Park.
May. I want you to call Carlos May and apologize.
Well, I was watching the game last night, and Steve Stone said something that was interesting that I wanted to share with you because I wanted to be like Lefty from Brookfield, Illinois, calling in to wow you with some sports trivia.
I would love to hear it.
There's this Lucas Giolito who has been moved up to the majors.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to know if you knew anything about his family because I thought this would be really exciting for you.
The Giolito family?
Uh-huh.
I don't. I don't know anything about his family. What's the background?
Giolito's father, Rick, has 10 acting credits on the IMDb page.
Yeah.
As the World Turns, Hunter, Who's the Boss, Jake and the Fat Man, and Twin Peaks. And Steve Stone said that Lucas Giolito's father played Susan's father on Seinfeld. Remember,
what?
She licked the envelope?
Yeah, she was George's fiance.
Right. And Lucas Giolito's dad was Susan's dad on the Seinfeld episode. Yes. I wanted to wow you.
That impressed me.
Hey, it's Lefty calling in from Brookfield. I want to wow Bill Leff.
That worked. Now, I'm not trying to one-up you, but I have one for you that is like this.
All right, but there's also...
Oh, you got more?
Well, it's a whole acting family.
The Giolitos?
His mother, Lindsay Frost, features 49 credits dating back to Hill Street Blues.
I know who Lindsay Frost is.
Oh, my God. I've wowed you again. And her brother.
She's got red, kind of curly reddish hair.
I don't know what she looks like.
Oh.
I just know she's been in a bunch of things.
Yeah, I know who she is.
She was on Without a Trace, Hill Street Blues.
Yeah, just and for a season. One story.
You
just,
do know her.
I do remember Lindsay.
And Lindsay's brother, Mark Frost, is the co-creator of Twin Peaks.
Oh, producer of Twin. Yeah. Wow. That's very impressive.
And he didn't pitch stellarly last night, but you know what? It'll come to him.
He's
and if not,
kid.
He can play in a baseball movie and act like a baseball player.
That's impressive. All of that is impressive. Now, I will share one with you. And I don't know. Maybe I've already told you this. I'm trying to think if I have. On the show that you love so much on NBC, This Is Us.
Yes.
All right. So it's a show about three triplets, and on almost every episode, if not every episode, they show flashbacks of the three adults when they were kids, right? All right. So the girl on the show, who's played by Chrissy Metz, the sister on the show, they keep showing her when she was a young teenager, like 11 or 12 years old.
Which she's dancing to Madonna or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's an episode at a swimming pool where some kids are mean to her. Remember
yes,
that?
Yes.
So that actress is played by the daughter of former Cubs third baseman Todd Zeal.
Really?
He's better. He played with the Cardinals for a bunch of years. He was only with the Cubs for a short time. But I saw her name in the credits, and the last name is Zeal. And I go, the only other Zeal I've ever heard of is Todd Zeal. And then I did some research, and it's her dad.
Well, how about that? How about that?
How about that?
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that
and
is
see,
amazing.
You know, Bill claims to be a fan of both teams, which I never believed
you.
I never used to believe you.
You know I am, though.
I do believe you now.
I like watching them both the same time.
No, you don't.
Switch back and forth and back and forth. Yes,
can't
they do.
Can't you figure out a picture-in-picture where you could watch them both at the
same time?
Probably
be easier, but why bother with that?
Well, I love the White Sox. My grandfather was a White Sox fan. He used to watch it on Channel 44 on his little black and white TV with the antenna was broken. He used to have pliers to change the channel.
Was Jack Drees calling the games back then?
I don't remember. I know Harry Carey was.
Yeah. Harry Carey came well after Jack Drees. He's when
was
Channel
I born
32,
when Jack Drees was playing?
He was doing it. He wasn't playing. He was calling the games. He was in the mid to late 1960s when Channel 32, it was more snow than it was actual broadcast. You just saw white fuzz, and every once in a while you could kind of see a ball being hit. And that's all you could see, but you watched anyway.
Well, so I'm going to the Sox game tonight, and a little tie into the Cubs because we're going to cover both of them because, you know, you like both of them.
Yes.
I just like one.
Yes.
But I do like Anthony Rizzo, and I will tell you this, that 8 Bar and Patio is the downstairs sister concept or bar, if you will, of the restaurant Maple and Ash. And they have partnered with the Anthony Rizzo Family Foundation to donate $1 from every downstairs burger or every charred bratwurst, or his favorite drink. Do you know what his favorite drink is?
Anthony Rizzo's favorite drink? Five Alive.
Nope. Can you guess Rizzo's favorite drink?
Sunny Delight.
No, it's a drink
at
a bar.
Oh, it's an actual alcoholic drink? Lime Ricky.
God, you're the worst guesser ever.
Come on.
It's a Crown and Ginger.
Oh, I was going to say Crown and Ginger. You made me say Lime Ricky. I wasn't going to say that.
What would that be? Crown Royal and ginger beer?
And ginger ale, probably.
Oh.
Or maybe ginger ale.
Huh. All right. Well, if you go to 8 Bar and Patio, it's right downstairs from Maple and Ash. It's part of their, it's under the umbrella. A dollar from every downstairs burger, charred bratwurst, or Crown and Ginger sold will go to the Anthony Rizzo Family Foundation to help knock cancer out of the park.
Good.
So it's a great cause. They're located at 8 West Maple, number one, suite number one, Chicago, Illinois. You can go to 8barchicago.com to find out all this information and just spell out 8, E-I-G-H-T. barchicago.com.
You know what impresses me about baseball? I watch it all the time. I love baseball. And every once in a while, there's something that still excites me. For instance, last night, a pitcher on the Reds got his first hit ever. So, you know, he gets the hit because you're not expecting him to get a hit because he's a pitcher. He gets the hit, and then the outfielder throws it into the dugout. And I thought to myself, even though you're a grown man and you've achieved the status of Major League Baseball player, it still means enough to you to get that ball back. You know, it's not like
that's
a little
really
leaguer
cute.
We're talking about.
It is
the
kind of.
The guy in his mid-20s.
It's a little leaguer at heart.
But he's going to keep that in some sort of a case on his shelf somewhere. I love seeing that.
Kevin, did you have the downstairs burger from 8 Bar and Patio? Was it delicious?
Yes, it was great.
I tried the bratwurst.
Pretty good?
It's pretty amazing. There's some kind of sauerkraut and cheesy sauce on it, and it's pretty good. Mm. So we would like listeners to partake in what... You didn't have anything?
No, I had some French fries.
The Parmesan fries?
Yeah, very, very good.
We don't like to eat, and you know, because a listener goes, big deal, they have free food. So we like to give away something to a listener.
To one listener.
How
one out
this?
Of the dozen of you will get a free treat.
A treat? 8 Bar and Patio, again, this is part of Maple and Ash. We have a dinner for two to give away.
Oh, that's very nice.
So pick the number you want.
I'm going to say number 9. Be caller number 9 right now at 312-981-7200. You'll win everything Wendy just described. Everything.
A dinner for two at 8 Bar and Patio. Again, it's right downstairs from Maple and Ash. And if you go there on your own, a dollar from every downstairs burger, charred bratwurst, or crown and ginger will go to the Anthony Rizzo Family Foundation to help knock cancer out of the park. Caller 9312-981-7200.
We have a winner, right?
Congratulations are in order I'd like to congratulate Paul from Algonquin.
English language is not the easiest.
I know. He'll be heading over to 8 Bar and Patio. It's right downstairs from Maple and Ash, which is 8 West Maple right here in Chicago. And this 8 Bar and Patio has partnered with the Anthony Rizzo Family Foundation to help knock cancer out of the ballpark. So if you purchase a downstairs burger, a charred bratwurst, or a crown and ginger, they'll donate a dollar from every one of those to the Anthony Rizzo Family Foundation.
That's nice of them to do.
The charred bratwurst, by the way, soft truffled onions, Dijonnaise, fine herbs, and warm poppy seed roll.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a king crab, avocado, and bib lettuce salad.
It sounds good.
I thought I was thinking of you.
I wouldn't eat the avocado. I'd ask for that to be on the side, but everything else sounds good.
All right, and I said that Lucas Gelito's father was in Seinfeld. I'm sorry, it was his grandfather.
No, you said grandfather.
I did?
Yeah.
Warren Frost, he played Susan's father in Seinfeld. And Lucas Gelito said he just was never interested in acting. His brother is doing it too, and he said he did a school play when he was in like fourth grade. And one of those really short, low-key ones where you don't have to learn many lines. And he said he didn't feel comfortable doing it. It wasn't for me. I just loved baseball ever since I was a little kid playing T-ball at 5 years old.
There's a lot of families whose, for some reason, their lineage is both baseball and theater.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we just mentioned two.
Kurt Russell's dad was an actor, and he was going to be a baseball player. He played minor league ball, never made it to the majors. Peter Marshall's son, former first baseman for the Cubs and the Royals.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why is the bleed over?
I don't know. They seem very different.
Yeah.
Right. I have no idea why.
You played a baseball fan in a baseball movie.
Right. So I combined my loves of both acting and baseball.
Too
hard. Not easy to do. It's not easy to do. Did you see this boy, 14-year-old kid, who got arrested for dancing the Macarena in Saudi Arabia?
It is the forbidden dance, Bill.
No, the Lambada is the forbidden dance.
Macarena, Lambada, what
the hell's the difference? Oh, Wendy, don't. Please. Now, Kevin's going to be arrested just for playing this in the background.
Every time we try to go out of the house, Jimmy Mac does the Macarena because he tries to find his wallet, his keys, and his phone. So he touches his shoulder, his other shoulder, his back pocket.
Jimmy Macarena.
Yeah, it drives me nuts.
A teenage boy was arrested for improper public behavior after he danced the Macarena at a set of traffic lights. Is this a story from 20 years ago? The Macarena is not still in vogue, is it?
Is today from 20 years ago?
I don't understand.
Because I don't know either.
To watch Austin Powers with me
yeah,
a little bit?
After the show, right. I'd love to watch that with you. Police in Saudi Arabia said on Tuesday that they detained a 14-year-old boy who was filmed dancing to the 1990s hit song in the coastal city of Jeddah. Return to the Jeddah.
Knew that was coming.
As well as the dance.
You've become predictable with Star Wars references.
I can't help myself sometimes. As well as the dance, the teenager whose name and nationality were not given.
Does it matter?
Yeah, because I would have tried to call him. And warn him about the dangers of dancing the Macarena.
This is so passé, though.
It's ridiculous. This song, this was popular 20 years. That was popular 40 years ago.
It's still at weddings, I think.
Isn't that crazy?
I would leave. If I'm at a wedding and the chicken dance breaks out, I'm leaving.
That's when you know that it's taken a turn.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as, forgive me if you're about to get married, anybody, but if you see your wedding reception turning into that,
well,
you
they
go,
get to choose their music, so keep that in mind. Bridie and groomy picked it.
That's always the low of any wedding is once the chicken dance breaks out.
Whatever.
Right?
You came for the drinks and the food anyways. You're sticking around.
I guess.
And you don't dance anyway, so really it doesn't matter.
I don't. Not only do I not dance, but I take pictures of people who are dancing and I publicly shame them.
I'm glad iPhones weren't around at my wedding because you were there.
Oh, a lot of people would have gone to the Huskow.
Mm-hmm.
It says it is not clear whether the boy, again, a 14-year-old boy in Saudi Arabia, would be formally charged. But it does say he was arrested. In the 45-second video, the teenager, who is wearing a striped T-shirt, a gray sports short, a pair of gray sports shorts, and a brightly colored pair of shoes, I don't know why any of that is pertinent to the story, strides to the middle of the crosswalk. He's actually very good. Kevin and I watched the video of him before. I don't know that I would have arrested him. I would have just said, young fella.
I just spit on you, sorry.
This dance that you're doing, although not illegal, is highly outdated. Find yourself a dance from today and come back.
Well, is it illegal in Saudi Arabia?
I think it is.
What about the electric slide? Had he done that, would he have been safe?
It doesn't say. It says the reason for his arrest was improper public behavior, so there must be something about the dance that in Saudi Arabia would be perceived as a little too much, a little too forward.
Perhaps you just have to fall in line and keep yourself very reserved while in public.
That's it.
You can only do the Macarena in your house.
In the privacy of your own.
Was he doing it to music or just the music in his head?
No, just the music in his head, Ryan.
That's even more impressive.
If he brought a boombox, and that would fit because everything this kid does is from 20 years ago, and then he played it real loud, then you go, okay, now you're creating a problem. People are just trying to go about their business, but you can't just Macarena in the middle of the street there. He says he starts dancing to the catchy tune. I do have to say
it is pretty catchy.
I'm not thrilled with it.
I know.
But it is hard to once you hear it, you go, I want to hear a little more of it.
You know how I know you weren't bothered by it? Because usually you would look to Kevin to say, fade the music down,
no,
and you didn't.
I actually strangely wanted to say to him because it just ran out. I'll play a little more Macarena.
See?
More? Okay. Yeah, it was his idea in the beginning. Yeah.
It's kind of really good.
I was at weddings. Remember Steve Sauer was our sound guy. They played this at his wedding, and I enjoyed it.
Did you
do it?
And
then what was the one that... No. I sat back and enjoyed it. What was the song that Ricky Martin used to sing?
Loco.
Live La Vida Loca.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's another one that if everything was right in the universe, you go, I should hate that song. But when it comes on, I go, oh, that's nice. What happened to me?
You're going to become a dancing fool.
How about that I'm Too Sexy song?
That's all right.
There
right,
you go.
Said
I'm right
Fred?
With that. Yeah.
I think deep down inside, you are
Go
the
on,
new Gene Gene the Dancing Machine.
Oh, you're being kind.
We're getting the song stuck in so many people's heads right now.
Macarena, Macarena.
Was it some Chicago news guy did this on air one night, and I want to say it was Sapelsa.
Sounds like something you'd
somebody
do.
In Chicago, some respected newsman.
John Drury.
Ryan, I don't think it's John Drury. I think it was Mark Sapelsa. I'm watching the news one night, and the song
Wasn't
comes on.
Warner, or not Warner Saunders, excuse me. It was Jackie Bang and Robert Jordan. Didn't they do it? They had
no,
some
they
kind
did,
of...
They do a dance. They
oh,
did a dance.
But not to this?
During commercial breaks.
Right, not
yeah.
this.
I loved that.
Was it Fahey Flynn?
With Jerry Taft?
Yeah. Fahey Flynn and Jerry Taft did a mambo together. No, it was. I'm almost
Papalo's
positive.
Mambo.
Mama number five is another one you can play for.
Right. Yeah, I like that one.
Bertrand's giving us
we'll
the
evil
eye.
Oh, he doesn't like dance. He's against the world of dance. All right, we'll take a quick break and then find out what Steve has on his show. A spoiler alert, it's not dancing. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.